I'm Brad Linder, and this is Newsworks Tonight. Dave Heller's off this evening. The campaign of Green Party candidate Jill Stein today is seeking a recount of the presidential vote in Pennsylvania, pursuing an unprecedented court action to contest the outcome. WHYY's Dave Davies reported the story this morning, and he's been following the developments throughout the day, and he joins me now in the studio. Dave, generally recounts happen in very close elections. Donald Trump won Pennsylvania by about 70,000 votes, though. How does the Green Party think this is going to work?
Well, you're right, Brad. The standard for a recount in Pennsylvania is a margin of 0.5% or less. Clearly not the case here. So what the Green Party has done is they've seized on a little-known provision of the state election code that says there will be a recount in any voting precinct in which three voters ask for it through a petition and affidavit. Now, the problem is there are deadlines in the code, and this effort comes very late. So the Green Party scrambled over the weekend to try and find voters willing to file these affidavits. Here's one. Her name is Jane Lipton. She's a Hillary Clinton voter from Winmore.
I got involved in this recount because I just feel that whether something is fraudulent or not, if people feel that it wasn't right, then it should be something that we should be able to do.
Yeah, so she filed her affidavit in Norristown today. Now, we don't know exactly how many of these petitions were filed, certainly over 100. Some counties won't accept them because they're beyond a tabulation period, but it seems clear there will be some recounts in precincts in the state.
But Pennsylvania has over 9,000 polling places across the state. What's going to happen by having recounts in just a couple of them? What do they hope it's going to do?
Right. Good question. Well, I want to bring in Larry Otter. He's the Pennsylvania attorney involved for the Stein campaign. You know, the concern has been raised about cyber hacking of election machines or the vote counting machinery. What Otter hopes is that these isolated recounts will convince officials or the courts to permit examination of the election machinery by the campaign's computer experts.
If we're successful with some of these recounts and we can get our computer guy to look at the little black box and the computers that are used to tabulate everything, you know, God forbid he finds that something happened, because then we're into really uncharted territory in Pennsylvania.
So you can hear there, he's almost afraid to find this Frankenstein of evidence that Russian hackers have been involved. Otter has filed an unprecedented motion in Commonwealth Court. This has never happened in Pennsylvania, a formal contest of the presidential vote in the state that can be initiated by 100 registered voters. The campaign found them and filed. The court will consider it, but Brad, the standard is very high here. The contest has to show there are enough illegally cast or at least tainted votes to reverse the outcome, which would be 70,000 votes.
So you've been talking to experts about this. What do they think? Is there a chance of this succeeding?
Mostly no. You know, the campaign's petitions rely on a University of Michigan computer expert who has a three-part analysis. One, he says voting systems are vulnerable to hacking. We've seen this. Two, it is plausible that Trump losing the popular vote and getting just enough votes in battleground states was the result of hacking. Not proven, but plausible. And three, you're never going to know unless you recount the votes and do a forensic examination of all the voting technology. The problem is that so far, and the Clinton campaign has acknowledged this, there's just no actionable evidence of hacking. So the filings are in. It's going to go to court. It'll probably be a few weeks before we get a result.
Dave Davies is senior reporter for WHYY. Thanks for joining us, Dave.
Thank you, Brett.
Fidel Castro's name ignites strong feelings among many Cubans who love the commander, as his supporters called him, and those who despise him as a tyrannical leader. WHYY's Katie Culinary spoke to some Cuban immigrants in our region about how they're reacting to his death.
Maria Delgado Pontani first saw the news that Fidel Castro had died on TV Saturday morning.
Part of me did a jig.
Delgado Pontani's family left Cuba when she was 2 years old. It was 1960, the year after Castro forced dictator Fulgencio Batista out of power, and someone warned Delgado Pontani's father that he should leave the country. So he moved his family to Philadelphia. Today, Delgado Pontani lives in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. She's ambivalent about Castro's death.
I hate him for what he did because of him, my family had to leave the place of my birth. But also because of him, I met my husband.
She says Castro did some good, especially for poor Cubans, like expanding access to education and health care. But she knows many Cubans would disagree.
Have you ever seen a photo of a hospital right now in Cuba?
Alain Martinez says his wife had to wait 2 years before she could have a life-saving hysterectomy. Martinez and his family moved to Lancaster, Pennsylvania last year, where he now works at an agency that resettles Cuban immigrants. He says he feels no emotion about Castro's death, happy or sad. But his words are laced with bitterness.
He died of old age on his own bed, on his own terms. How is that even fair for the thousands of families that are being separated for 50 years? Or those people that were killed in firing squads without due process?
With Castro's brother Raul still in power, Martinez says he doesn't expect much to change for those he left behind. Katie Culinary, WHYY News.
Ask veterans why they joined the military, and you'll get a variety of answers. Many use it as a stepping stone once they get back to the civilian world. But sometimes soldiers make some serious mistakes once they leave the service, and that can make the transition to civilian life even tougher. As a part of our Veterans Coming Home project, WHYY's Laura Benchoff talked to three men who committed crimes after serving in the military about what they're doing with their second chances.
You would press the enter key on the keyboard.
45-year-old Shaf Randolph is taking a basic computer software class at the Veterans Multi-Services Center in Philadelphia. He already knows Microsoft Office, so he lends a hand when other veterans in class get stuck.
Over to the right.
Randolph is trying to get back on his feet after serving 8 years in prison. He says his crimes were less of a misstep and more the result of a bad environment.
I went back hanging with the same crowd I was hanging with before because they was doing the same exact thing, and I just went right back and adapted to my same old environment.
During the first Gulf War, Randolph spent 4 years in the United States Navy as an electrician who serviced fighter jets. But after he finished his tour, he says he had no luck finding civilian aviation jobs.
You can go to an airport, but when you go to an airport and tell them I used to be an aviation electrician, it's made on a United States aircraft carrier, I can tell them 4 years I did it. But they want certifications for that. You don't get no type of certification.
Back in North Philadelphia's Logan section, where he grew up, he turned to selling drugs and doing odd jobs. While the armed services do market military experience as a stepping stone to a civilian career, for the kind of work Randolph did, you need more than 1,000 hours of additional training to work in the private sector. Like Randolph, veteran Bill Cobb hoped more doors would swing open for him after he served in the military.
I had no intentions of ever joining the military, but as I felt my options for doing something to escape the inevitable outcomes that most people in my neighborhood are forced to deal with, I enlisted in the Air Force.
At 20, while working part-time and taking classes at LaSalle University, he joined the Air Force Reserves. A few months later, his unit was called up to serve in Germany.
It was the most serious job that I ever had. It was the most structured job that I ever had. It was an opportunity to make more money than I ever had.
Cobb worked as a medical specialist at a MASH unit, unloading hundreds of patients from C-130 airplanes carrying wounded from Iraqi battlefields. He was quickly promoted to the head of a small team. That flush of responsibility and leadership ended when his unit was deactivated a few months later. He went back to school and his part-time jobs, including one as a delivery man. While he was serving, some of his coworkers at UPS had earned full-time union jobs. But for Cobb, the clock had stopped running.
And I'm like, dude, I went away for war, and it wasn't, I didn't volunteer to do this. I was called and I had to go. Like, that's not fair. I want a promotion. I want to be where my friends are.
Cobb, who had been homeless for a part of his childhood, was also trying to take care of his mother. Hoping to make a quick windfall, he agreed to drive a local drug dealer who was planning to kidnap a rival's girlfriend. And they got caught. Cobb served 6.5 years for his first and only criminal conviction. Both Cobb and Randolph committed felonies after serving in the armed forces. Both also say they could have done a better job taking advantage of military benefits after service, like money to pay for school. But Randolph says he joined the Navy because he knew college wouldn't be a good fit. He resents that his specialized experience, fixing A-6 jets, wasn't recognized outside the military.
I'm bitter because I thought that when I came home, the doors was going to be open. Oh, you're a vet. We're going to help you.
He was released from prison in April 2016 and hopes to start his own commercial trucking company, an idea he got from a job training class while in prison.
It's kind of strange to say, but I think prison life got me more ready for society than the service.
He says he wants to start a business so he can hire other people in his shoes. Bill Cobb became a professional advocate for ex-offenders after being fired repeatedly when employers found out he'd done time. Cobb and Randolph both spent less than a decade behind bars and are now focused on the future. Meanwhile, Melvin Dill, who served in the Marine Corps during Vietnam, has made it his goal to help veterans currently in prison, some for life.
I believe 45 and 50 years for a crime, that's enough time. I mean, I think treatment is much better than incarceration.
Dill received mental health treatment and a lenient sentence after committing a crime that stemmed from a traumatic injury while serving. He's currently working with Pennsylvania legislators on an act that would give other veterans who commit crimes a second chance.
It's going to introduce why veterans need some type of parole, some type of pardon for their crimes, due to the fact that they did have military injuries that caused them to commit a criminal act.
California, Minnesota, Illinois, and New Hampshire already have similar laws, which also make sure war-related psychological injuries count in court. Besides lobbying Harrisburg, Dill sees his role as being a face and voice for veterans who are invisible to the general public. For WHYY, I'm Laura Benchoff.
There's an elephant in the room, or at least in our intergalactic neighborhood. In this week's edition of Sky Talk, NewsWorks Tonight's Dave Heller sat down with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute, to talk about a big find near our own galaxy and how we previously missed it.
Derek, we look out to what we think is getting close to the very beginning of time and space, that Big Bang some 13.5 billion light years ago. What are we missing in our neighborhood?
It's as if there are things right under our nose that we hadn't spied before. Yet there are reasons why we have these blind spots around the sky that make it difficult for us to see surprisingly large and massive objects that are right nearby. A group of astronomers working with the South African Large Telescope and the Anglo-Australian Telescope have recently done a spectroscopic survey of a region of our Milky Way galaxy. And what they've discovered is that just beyond our Milky Way galaxy, in the direction of the constellation Vela, the Sail, about 800 light years out, is a supercluster of galaxies. So there could be thousands of galaxies in this supercluster of galaxies, all arranged in clusters. If we start with our own galaxy, the Milky Way, we know that our own galaxy is part of a local group of galaxies of about 50. But if you could imagine clusters of galaxies, say maybe a few hundred to a few thousand galaxies as a cluster, and then clusters of those clusters, then this is what we're speaking about.
How did we miss it?
Well, the way we missed it is that we have this interesting blind spot in our view of the night sky. So imagine we have right in front of us, right at eye level, a Frisbee, and we're looking at this Frisbee edge on. Well, if we can imagine ourselves as being right on the edge of the Frisbee, if we look toward the center of the disk of the Frisbee, then the Frisbee itself blocks our view of what's behind the Frisbee. Well, let's think of our galaxy the same way. Our sun, our star, is out on one of the outer edges of our galaxy, not quite to the edge, but about two-thirds of the way out from the center of our galaxy. So when we look toward the center of our galaxy, through the constellation Sagittarius, what we find is that the band of stars, dust, and gas that makes up the central portion of our galaxy, that central portion of the Frisbee, obscures what's behind the galaxy. And in this region, we've been able to identify a new supercluster. It's not that we haven't discovered other superclusters nearby. There is one called the Shapley supercluster. But that Shapley supercluster isn't quite as large as this supercluster is. It seems as if when we look at this supercluster of galaxies, we're seeing an enormous number that could be well more than 8,600 galaxies.
Yikes.
If we were to imagine that each galaxy has, say, between 100 and 400 billion stars each, researchers are estimating that this cluster, called the Vela supercluster, could contain between 1,000 trillion and 40 quintillion stars.
Derek, I can't let you go without noting that Wednesday marks an auspicious anniversary, a close encounter for one Elizabeth Hodges.
So this is a really interesting one. I like this because, you know, there's so much concern and worry about an unfortunate encounter with a meteor or a meteorite striking Earth. And we talk about the possibility of what could happen going forward in the future. We know there's something out there. We know there's something of some size. It's just a matter of when it's going to get to us that we'll have this close encounter of a not too pleasant kind. But if we look back at the records of history, we find that it was back in 1954, November the 30th, in which Elizabeth Hodges was actually struck by a meteorite that crashed through the roof of her home, bounced around the living room, and struck her as she lay on a couch, possibly watching TV.
She lived to tell the tale?
She actually did. This is actually the only recorded instance in which a human was actually struck by a meteorite. So when you think about all of the meteorite falls that have occurred throughout history, it's actually quite remarkable that we have no record of anyone being struck before.
Is that primarily because most of them can be measured in fractions of ounces rather than pounds?
Yeah, for the most part. If humans had been around in the much earlier history of the Earth, it might be possible that humans wouldn't have made it at all, since there was so much more meteoritic impact early in the Earth's history.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight.
If you find Earth boring, just the same old, same thing. Come on, sign up without a space, Ways Incorporated. If you find Earth boring...
A new musical called Found is playing at Philadelphia Theater Company. It's based on a true story of a group of friends in Chicago who collected notes on scraps of paper they found at restaurant tables, in library curls, and the like. They put them into a magazine they called Found. WHYY theater blogger Howard Shapiro has this review.
You see a scrap of paper on the sidewalk, you probably ignore it. Not Davy Rothbart. He picked up scribbled musings and doodles and random notes, and so did his friends, and a collection of these became the first issue of the magazine Found. Now, playwrights Hunter Bell and Lee Overtree and composer Eli Bullen have taken many of the Found notes and created a musical about Rothbart and his friends and the making of their magazine. The show debuted off-Broadway 2 years ago, and its creators thought it needed work, so they came to Philadelphia Theater Company to polish what's now a greatly revamped version. Its concept is thin. Finding notes and publishing them is interesting only up to a point. So Found has a love story, too, but it's old hat. What makes the show work and work well is the notes themselves, often sung by the peppy cast or read with attitude while the originals are projected onto the stage set. Some are sad, like one found in a drawer. It asks a mom why she doesn't ever come during visiting hours or even send pictures of the kids. Like many of the notes, it's out of context, so we don't know whose kids or where the writer is, but we clearly get the feeling behind it. All the notes are said to be real, even the one that reads, "Be right back," and is signed Godot. Some are simple navel gazers, like this.
Getting chubby, bunny tummy, unless I start exercising.
And others are thoughts from the blue, like this one to Charles Dickens, maybe from a student in a literature class.
You have to make up your mind, Mr. Dickens, was either the best of time or the worst of time. It could scarcely be more.
Some of the funniest moments in Found come when it offers possible backstories for the notes. It's a high-gear 100-minute show and a welcome relief from the political intensity that spawned the awful notes and epithets reported over the past weeks. The Found notes in the show may be random, but taken together, they point to their anonymous writers as being human and wanting to express it. The Philadelphia Theater Company production of Found is at the Suzanne Roberts Theater through December 11th. For WHYY, I'm Howard Shapiro.
That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Brad Linder for Newsworks Tonight.